Stern at 2 kilometres to go. Everybody is at the limit of their speed.
This could be one of the great wins in the history of the Boston Marathon.
That relief, yes, is the only thing they could say.
Can they get the world record? It's a tough world record.
Welcome back to Endurance Planet. This is your host, Tawny Prazak, and today we have a pretty cool Skype-style roundtable discussion with some very important folks in the world of health and fitness. This is a good one, guys. Joining the show for the first time, and we are honored to have him, is Chris McDougall, who most of you know as the man who made minimalist running more mainstream with his book, Born to Run. And can you believe that that was 6 years ago? Well, Chris is back with a new book out called Natural Born Heroes, and I had a unique opportunity to interview not just Chris, but we also have on the line with us Dr. Phil Maffetone and Hal Walter, and the conversation that ensues is quite epic. What you're going to hear are concepts presented in Chris's new book, such as the need for natural movement and functional fitness as a way of life, and how Chris dug deep into history to find stories dating all the way back to World War II as prime examples to support his arguments in the book. We go even beyond that, and we also learn how folks like Phil and Hal have greatly inspired Chris, namely with Phil's approach to nutrition and fat burning. You'll hear Chris's experience with Phil's two-week test. And Hal is quite the guy, you guys. His athletic accomplishments run deep, namely in pack burro racing. What a sport that is, and we're going to learn all about it. And now, before we get into it, a few things. First of all, I have to apologize because about halfway through the interview, the Skype connection got really terrible with interference coming through. And of course, our audio editor ninja, Brock, did his best to clean this up for your listening pleasure. But I do apologize for somewhat of yucky audio quality. It was one of those freak things. We don't even know why it was happening. And we didn't want to have to reschedule this call, given the cool guys that we had on the line. And bringing all these people together wasn't easy, as you can imagine. And also, before we dive into it, I want to let you know that this episode of Endurance Planet is brought to you by Generation UCAN Superstarch, the revolutionary new fuel source that enhances fat burning and metabolic efficiency for optimal sports performance and health. You can head to enduranceplanet.com/UCAN to find out more and get 15% off your purchase. You can also use the code EndurancePlanet if you're shopping over at generationucan.com. We have links to all this for your convenience in the show notes, so you can head over there to easily click and buy. And if you want to read how I've been personally using UCAN, including in my recent marathon and all the training that led up to it, and which equated to a BQ, you can head to my blog at triton.com. Even got some recipes there for you guys. And while you're shopping and playing around on the internet, be sure to head to the show notes for this post at enduranceplanet.com, where you can grab a copy of Chris's new book, Natural Born Heroes, where we've provided the Amazon link for easy purchasing. Last but not least, if you could head over to iTunes and rate Endurance Planet, leave us a review. We would love to hear from you. I love hearing all your feedback of all sorts. And your ratings help increase exposure of the show so more people can learn about it and benefit. And that is it for announcements. Let's go ahead and dive into this conversation with Chris McDougall, Dr. Phil Maffetone, and Hal Walter. Thank you so much for tuning in.
I'm around people like Hal and Phil who've worked with top level elite athletes. So I'm still trying to navigate that myself, trying to find out what is the proper balance between being super competitive, but also trying to be just relaxed and functional.
I couldn't agree with you more. Like, I just got finished doing my first open marathon and Phil was helping me out for it. And I had goals like qualify for Boston and stuff, which I did. But I think being so dedicated to like triathlon the way I was for so many years, it just was over the top. And now it's like, well, I want to go out like I did this morning and stand up paddleboard for a couple hours. Who cares if I'm fast or slower? I mean, I want to be able to feel good and be strong at it. But the competition side of it, like, I'm a competitive person, but I see what you're saying. Like, it, the way it kind of evolves in your own journey.
Exactly right. Yeah.
I think one of the answers about competition is whether you're enjoying it. And the problem with many people is they don't enjoy it, and they still do it, and they still are obsessed in an unhealthy way about it. I competed for many years, and I got to the point where I didn't enjoy it anymore. It hit me in the middle of a race, and I just stopped and went home. Mm. So I think when you stop having fun, and this is true in all aspects of life, when you stop having fun, don't do it.
Yeah.
You know, that has been my experience in pack burrow racing, is that I've really tuned into enjoying it. And here I am, 55. I've lost I don't have to win. I like to win, but the main thing is enjoying it. And I'm finding that I'm staying pretty successful by enjoying it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what it's all about, for sure. Of course, we are joined by Chris McDougall and Phil Maftone and Hal Walter, right? That's your last name, Hal?
Yes.
And we're going to have a pretty cool discussion today because, as many of you know, Chris McDougall is a successful author of Born to Run, and he's got a new book out now, Natural Born Heroes. And it seems like the next level of what Born to Run sort of started to embody in the movement, you know, with the minimalist movement and all that kind of stuff. This is kind of like the next level of that. And it's interesting because so much of it ties into the concepts that Phil Maffetone seems to have been promoting, you know, since the 80s and whatnot. And so I'm curious how you guys actually know each other, how your guys' paths crossed. How long have you been friends?
It's a weird thing with all these topics. I feel like I'm really late to the party, and I'm surprised that people aren't a little bit more resentful that I get credit for stuff that other people have been talking about for 30 years. But what's happened with me personally is I'll hear about something like barefoot running or fat is fuel. And to me, it seems to answer a question that I'll have about, for instance, resistance fighters during World War II. How on earth do these guys live off the land for weeks at a time without access to steady food supplies? Mm-hmm. Then I'll hear about fat is fuel, and then I'll hear that a guy named Phil Maffetone has developed this years ago, but how the hell do you find him, Phil Maffetone? And then I come across a name like Hal Walter. So it all becomes this word of mouth network that leads you back to the people that have had deep experience in this. And it becomes its own community of people who are all approaching the same truths from different directions.
So did you seek out, Chris, did you seek out Phil and kind of pick his brain on the whole fat is fuel and the Maffetone method and all that, like, years back? Or was this kind of new to you too, even like learning about this stuff?
It was new to me. And I think the derivation was exactly that. I was researching Born to Run. I heard about a guy called the Cretan Runner, and I thought, who's this guy? And well, it turns out he wasn't a runner in the conventional sense of a racer. He was a foot messenger during World War II. And then I began to read up on this guy. I thought, how the hell is this guy running 75 miles at a time through the Cretan Mountains, you know, dodging 80,000 pissed off German soldiers? And he doesn't have access to aid stations. He doesn't have like cliff shots. He doesn't have Gatorade. How does this guy physically survive? And somehow I come across a reference to fat adaptation, fat is fuel, and it seemed that all roads about fat adaptation led back to Phil. Hmm. But I didn't know who Phil was, and I didn't know how to find him. And I came across one of Phil's old books, and in the back was a reference to Hal Walter. Well, I happened to meet Hal by chance at the 2006 Leadville Packboro race. So I contacted Hal, said, can you put me in touch with this guy, Phil? So it's all this very sort of Hansel and Gretel-y following the breadcrumbs through the forest, leading back to the guy who had the answers, who was Phil, who, again, was extraordinarily gracious about sharing this amazing treasury of information.
Yeah, seriously, we're all very grateful to Phil Maffetone and what he's done. And I'm glad to see things getting even more popular these days. Because like you're saying, Chris, it's like, you said this about Born to Run. I read it in one of your interviews. You know, you were kind of on the wave at the right time. And it seems like right now with this like natural movement stuff, you know, it dates back quite a ways, as we'll discuss. But right now there seems to be these resurgence, and even people like Phil Maffetone, whose ideas and concepts are nothing new, all of a sudden, like, people are starting to perk their ears and really understand, like, this is legit stuff we're talking about here.
I think the difficulty with having your hands around time-tested truths is it's very hard to monetize them. Mm. I think that it's really easy to make a lot of money off of crap. You know, you can sell a bunch of crap and people think it's exciting and new, and you can make a ton of money. And that's why gyms and gym machines and built-up running shoes are profitable, and you hear a lot about them. But fat adaptation is kind of free. running barefoot. It's free. And so the difficulty is, if you can't roll out some glitzy new product every 6 months and have Runner's World write 2,500 words about it, then you become obscure. And that's the difficulty. I think the things that are true and last and work are essentially free.
Totally. I couldn't agree more. And, you know, you didn't even mention sports nutrition products in that sentence, but that's like definitely probably the biggest one of all right here. Cause you go back to the Cretion guy. I think his nickname was the clown, from what I've read in a couple of interviews on you. And like you said, like he was really not eating much except maybe down in a little moonshine and running back and forth 50 plus miles at a time. Like, how do you do that, right?
Well, that was a funny thing, too. So, again, when I'm on the trail of Phil, it might have been easier for other people to find Phil. For me, I found it really baffling. I couldn't find a phone number or an email address. But when I came across Hal's name, then I started reading up more on Hal. I realized, holy crap, Hal did the same thing as the Cretan runner. Huh. Hal won the world championship Tackboro race at age 53 on a water bottle. You know, he's not drinking, he's not downing goose and shots. And I'm realizing that this guy is doing the same thing as my Cretan runner. So that to me was like the worlds were starting to converge.
Yeah.
I have a living example of exactly what we're talking about.
So Phil, what do you think, you know, in your career, basically promoting things like as Chris is saying, you know, it's not the money makers. It's hard to monetize these concepts. How has that affected your career? We've never really talked about that together.
Well, I don't know how it affected my career. My focus in my career, my passion was all about helping people. And I wasn't going into business. I was going into practice. And my goal was to help people. And I actually had a lot of different populations of patients, if we want to refer to them that way. I had a lot of kids, a lot of young mothers, a lot of families, and a lot of athletes. And the athletes became something that I was known for. But it was the same issue with athletes. I wanted to help them get healthier. And what I noticed is as I did that, they also performed better. And that's what my career has really been all about from 1977 when I first started practice.
So as we were just kind of talking about too, the difference between, you know, kind of having like all around functional fitness, just, you know, being able to train for life, so to speak, versus being kind of competitive for a specific event. Like, you know, I think that directly can affect someone's health. I've seen this even in myself and having to step away from hardcore competition and be a little bit more free with things. But Phil, like you've worked with the world's best athletes, you know, kind of taking what Chris is saying right now, of just having that ability to just be, you know, natural mover and up for anything, fit for anything. Like, how do you help guide athletes when they want a little bit of both? Like me, for example.
Well, the first thing I do is emphasize something that's very important, which is that you want to develop fitness without sacrificing your health. And that's foreign to a lot of athletes. And when they finally understand it, one of two things happens. Either they say, "Oh, okay, I'll buy that," or they say, "Oh no, it's all about fitness. And if I have to sacrifice my health for an extra place in a race, then that's what I do." And then I say, "Okay, well, I can't work with you then because that's not what I'm all about." So it's kind of a hard sell, and but it's for me, it's a requirement. It's a requirement for myself, and it's a requirement for anybody I work with.
And Chris, I mean, you've been in this scene for like pretty hardcore now for years. What are you seeing how things are evolving? Like even like speaking to your new book, people, do you think that people are getting away from being uber competitive about a specific distance and wanting to be more open to new concepts of athleticism?
You know, I had a conversation with Phil about my mother-in-law who's diabetic, and you know, Phil can cure a diabetic, but what he can't cure is a diabetic's mindset. So when we were talking to Phil about this, he just kind of had this look on his face. It's like, you know what? You're not going to convince someone to do something they don't want to do. Now, I was kind of surprised. I thought he was going to run down a laundry list of things we should do with my mother-in-law to make her healthier. And he opened my eyes to something, which is that if you don't see it yourself, if you don't want to do it, no one's going to talk you into it. And that's where we are with fitness right now. In some ways, it's a golden age. basically because we're coming out of a dark age. We've seen now 30 years of crap that doesn't work. We've seen the gym model, the machine model, the bodybuilding model, the overcushioning model, the hyper-competitive model. That's what we've been locked in for 30 years. It doesn't work. People are injured. They're unhappy. They're staying away from the gyms. So coming out of that dark age, we're now seeing things like trail running, which is really being out playing in the woods. We're seeing an emphasis on ultra marathons where people are less interested in finishing times and places and more interested in just finishing. We're seeing things like parkour, natural movement, wild fitness. So in that regard, more people are opening their eyes to the fact that the old model isn't working and there's an ancient model which is better. The downside is that the forces of evil, basically the marketing forces, are keep shoving stuff at us. And I have to say, I have kind of a pessimist viewpoint that the marketing and the salesmanship over time are going to win out over the really ancient and more enlightened ways to approach things.
I'm waiting for the parkour challenge.
Oh my gosh!
Here's the thing.
Sponsored by Gatorade or something.
I had a great conversation with a guy named Dan Edwards. And Phil, this is a guy that you two guys have got to get together. You love Dan Edwards. Dan Edwards is a wonderful parkour instructor and coach in London. And I had that conversation with him. I said, "So, what's your position on the debate about competition?" And Dan just shook his head and said, "There is no debate. Parkour is never about competition. If it's competition, it's not parkour." And his point is, this is a skill. Painters aren't competing against each other to see who can paint better. They're trying to learn the skill and create a masterpiece. And you don't do that by trying to beat the other guy.
Beautifully said, for sure. Now, tie this in. I'm curious to hear a little bit more about, is it Georges Herbert? How do you say his name? That natural movement guy, author?
I'm going to make you try like seven more times before I tell you.
No, you don't want to go there with me because there's an ongoing joke about how I butcher people's names on this show. Even though I come from a journalist background and I have the best of intentions, I swear. But his concepts, natural movement, you know, this dates back to the early 1900s. Talk a little bit about what he was saying then and how you're seeing, you know, maybe this can be like what we can start thinking about this day and age in a more modern age.
One thing that I use as a test point for anything I was going to research was, is this a one-off fad or can we see it happening again and again throughout history? What I was looking for was some credibility on a timeline. So if I'm talking about fat adaptation, I don't want to just hear that some guy in Oracle, Arizona is doing this. I want to see that it appears again and again throughout history. And to me, that gives us some credibility. So with natural movement, there's a guy named Georges Herbert. He was a French naval officer back in the early 1900s. And he was stationed on a troop ship off the coast of Martinique when the volcano of Martinique began to explode. So Herbert hops into a lifeboat with several other French sailors, and they start steaming towards shore to try to save people's lives. And what they saw were, you know, tens of thousands of people were dying because they couldn't execute a few simple animal skills. They couldn't swim a few yards offshore. They couldn't pull themselves up a rope. They couldn't pick up a 40-pound child. You know, 40 pounds is not heavy, but children are not balanced properly. They don't have handles. Mm-hmm. But the thing about what Herbert realized was, why is it that every other species can save itself? They can run, they can fly, they can execute these animal skills, yet somehow humans are helpless in the face of a physical challenge. And he realized the reason why is because, you know, we take these super healthy 5-year-olds that spend all their time practicing survival skills, climbing and jumping and fighting and fleeing, and we sit them down at age 5 at a desk and say, now don't move for like 15 years until you graduate. And what he understood was, we have taken these wonderful skills and let them deteriorate.
Mm-hmm. And so what kind of solutions, if any, do you present in the new book to overcome some of that modern society? And, you know, it's not even just kids either. Obviously, it gets even worse with adults, and then we get locked up and our functional fitness just goes out the door, even if we're athletes too, as you probably are all too familiar with.
You know, I'll shift you over to where we are today. So today I'm at Hal Walter's house in Westcliff, Colorado. When I say in Westcliff, I should say out in the mountains around Westcliff.
Yeah, it looks beautiful.
And we were having this great conversation today about packboro racing. Now, Hal was a sub-240 marathoner back in the day, but he got away from strict road racing and got into packboro racing. And as we talked about today, I realized what locked in for Hal was the fact that this was an all-around challenge, that you know, you go out in a road race, it's basically you and your Garmin in the finish line. Your head's down, you're just huffing out the miles, mile after mile. But when you're out on a trail with another living creature, your brain is on high alert. You're thinking about yourself, about the animal, about the weather conditions, what can spook the animal. And to me, that's what it's all about. We keep thinking about training our bodies, but are we training our minds as well? And that's what natural movement's all about, mind and body together. And I think Hal could probably speak a lot to that too.
Yeah, Hal, please do if you want to, especially well, sure. I didn't realize you were such an accomplished marathoner as well.
Well, thank you. And one of the things Chris and I were talking about also is that humans have lost their connection with animals and working with animals over the modern era, I guess you would call it. And there's a fitness component to that. And it also struck me that in Chris's new book, this band of misfits on Crete kidnap a Nazi general. And they're moving him around on a donkey all over this mountainous country in Crete. And Chris can speak to this more than I can, but apparently this donkey was his prized possession in a village. And the person that was the best donkey handler was recruited to drive the donkey with the general they'd kidnapped all the way across the island, essentially.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And actually, Chris, could you elaborate on that story a little bit? Because you kind of caught my attention when I was reading a couple interviews and you started mentioning this whole situation.
Yeah, that was a starting point for the book was, you know, I read about this Cretan runner and the resistance. I thought that's kind of cool. And it turned out that it wasn't just a coincidence that these bizarre adventures were happening on the island of Crete. So you don't hear much about this, but Crete was actually the turning point of World War II. After the Germans conquered all of Western Europe, they basically kicked the crap out of every major army in Western Europe, 9 armies in a matter of like 9 months. It was an unbelievable win streak. All that Hitler had to do next is defeat Russia, and he wins. He wins the war because there's no way the U.S. would have gotten involved at that point. If Hitler controlled all of Eastern and Western Europe, he would have had armies of soldiers, millions strong. He would have had all of the oil resources, all the food resources of the entire continent. There's no way the U.S. would have opposed him. But the crucial step was getting to Moscow and defeating the Red Army, which actually should have been pretty easy because the Red Army was a piece of crap. It was a terrible army, awful leaders. Stalin was a lunatic, really soft target. But the only step he had to do in between was lock down the Greek island of Crete, which is kind of that little stone, in the stepping stone in the river that you step across from Western to Eastern Europe. The problem was Crete was this unique place. It was this island that had been really sort of cut off from the rest of the world for centuries because it was always occupied by invaders. And on Crete, the ancient Greek art of the hero still survived. You know, we think of the Greek heroes as being these sort of fantasy figures, but for the Greeks, they weren't. This was an actual code of conduct. It was a way of taking the natural human attributes that we all have, like fat adaptation, like the ability to run cross country long distances, the ability to be elusive and agile. These are natural skills we all have. The ability to throw with accuracy, which is particular to humans. And the Greeks just said, look, it's everybody's responsibility to practice these things. And that was still true on Crete. So when the Germans show up, the Cretans are ready to go, man. They are ready to fight. And they held the Germans up for so long that by the time the Germans were finally able to get off of Crete and head toward Moscow, it was too late. The snow began to fall. The German soldiers got caught in a cold, hard winter. And they basically were defeated by the snow more than by the Red Army. And that was the turning point of the war.
That's so interesting. And I mean, and to think that we're actually kind of talking about these concepts on an endurance sports podcast right now, but how related it is and like how history can teach us those lessons. It's kind of cool. I kind of like it. And how, you know, I wanted to get back to then your story. I did have a follow-up question for you and, you know, how your time being hardcore with marathoning to achieve what you did then compares with what you've experienced with the donkey and the burro racing that you do.
Well, we just talked about this a little while ago here, and I had run 2 marathons before I gave pack burro racing a try, and all of a sudden it was this situation that running seemed like putting one foot in front of the other and nothing else. There was so much more going on in pack burro racing. The starts were like I used to call them an aerobic rodeo. They were so wild and woolly, and and the animals had such a herding instinct from the start. I mean, you could literally be hanging on for dear life to a rope running a 5-minute mile out of town in a 30-mile race. Mm-hmm. And it just captivated my imagination. And we were just talking about, would I have stuck with running if I hadn't discovered pack burro racing? And I think the answer is no. I don't think running had enough going on for me, even though I had, you know, some moderate speed and it seemed to be doing fairly well at it. I don't know that it would have captivated me the way that working with an animal, training an animal as well as myself, and also the rugged nature of the courses that these races are held on. I mean, almost all of our races start at an elevation of 10,000 feet. Mm. And they go, the two biggest races go up to the top of a rugged mountain pass called Mosquito Pass. It's 13,187 feet high, and that's the turnaround. And on the way up this pass, you're going through icy streams, you're crossing boulder fields, you're going through spongy tundra. It's just an epic experience. And the running ended up being great conditioning for a really hard sport.
Mm, it's so awesome to me. I mean, and that's, again, like where, like, I find with that athleticism, regardless of what time or pace, what that requires, and just that relationship between you and the animal is just really, really interesting. Again, I think we need to do a dedicated show to this on the podcast, because I know we have another listener out there with the initials GZ who's really into this as well. You know, Phil, I have a question for you related to all this stuff. Again, you're so used to working with high-level, high-performance athletes. But when you were talking about this idea of, you know, maybe taking a bit of a step back from the competitive side of things and looking at our athleticism more from like skill standpoints and everything, how would you suggest we as athletes monitor ourselves and make sure that we're being true to this and not getting too deep into just being competitive for one event? Or would you suggest maybe at times it is okay to kind of just go that like extra step to be as specific as you need for that race, like your Mark Allens of the world?
Well, that's your choice. I think if you start with the important issue of what is my passion, what do I really want to do, and then make sure you're having fun, that's going to get you a lot of benefits from a health standpoint, and then if your goal is to keep improving your fitness and balancing it with health, then you're in pretty good shape. I think what I've seen in the past with people I've worked with is a common theme, which is that from year to year, we may all change. Our goals may change. Our desires may change. We might have fun doing something, and then, okay, we're ready for the next thing. Even though I don't compete, there's a lot of different things I do, physical things. Movement is important, and we have to move, and we have to move in different ways. Humans are among the most amazing animals from a movement standpoint. We can do so many different things, the most important of which is endurance and weaving things into endurance, whether it's racing with an animal or racing after an animal. For years I thought, you know, for me, I kind of wanted some kind of a standard, and my standard for a while was, well, I should be able to run after this deer through the woods, and I should be able to track this deer down to the point where if I needed to cut him up and eat him, I could, but I didn't have to go that far, but I wanted to see if I can do it. And it was really a lot of fun.
So I guess the question becomes then, like, how do you assess an athlete to know, like, what's healthiest for that person at the time? Like, because obviously we love watching these incredible performances from athletes and breaking records. And Phil, you even just wrote a book about the potential to break a 2 hours on the marathon and stuff. So we want that kind of stuff in life. But when do we know that, you know, maybe we need to kind of switch things up for a little bit more balance in our lives?
Well, I think we have to use our instincts, use our intuitions to look at if we're going off course.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we have a knee injury, that could be an indication that we're doing something wrong. It usually is. If we're overtrained, if we're getting depressed, you know, we often know that, our young kids who are playing Little League baseball or, running track, we know that sometimes they need to be encouraged. Well, they always need to be encouraged, but we also have to be aware that we can encourage them too much. We can kind of put ourselves into them and, make them think that, you know, they have to do it for us. But then when we get to be adults, we don't realize that we're doing the same thing to ourselves sometimes. So we have to look at all these things and, the social pressures, the peer pressures, these things kind of drift in, and they're the unhealthy features of all of it. And we just have to be aware of it. I'd like to see athletes evaluate themselves. I have a lot of testing protocols that I do.
Phil, I think thinking even with my own experience, a lot of times you speak to the idea of like not necessarily being happy with something. It's more about admitting that you need that transition. Like you're so used to the routine of doing one thing, but then it gets to the point where you're not as happy and you know you need something else, but you don't really know how to take those steps. Again, I know this was kind of the case for me there for a while. How do you help people with that? I mean, maybe even your own journey from being, like you mentioned, that one day you were racing, you just stopped and you're like, this is not what I want to be doing right now.
Yeah, I think sometimes it's important to recommend that an athlete do something different from that moment. And I often use walking as a guide. Sometimes it's a transition from one season to the next where people have a hard time winding down. In the case of Mike Pigg one time, I recommended that he chop a lot of wood in November instead of working out.
Wait,
walking is a great thing.
Real quick, did he actually do that? Take that recommendation?
He did, yeah.
Okay.
He did. Yeah, he ended up with a lot of wood for the winter. I think the schedule can be a problem. I think people have this obsession that, you know, where's my schedule? And I need my schedule so I know what to do today. Well, I want to go out the door and not quite be sure what I want to do. I've gone out the door to go for a hike and ended up running, or go for a run and ended up biking, or just turned the other way and walked into the woods and wandered through the woods for a while. I just think we need to use our instincts. That's what all animals do. And humans have gotten away from it.
You know, Tony, there's a thing too. We keep having our plans, but like nature doesn't give a crap about our plans.
Yeah.
And usually our plans are based on some idea we have in our mind. Like the whole idea of actually running a marathon is kind of an absurd notion. It's so unnatural. No indigenous human would ever try to run 26 miles as fast as they possibly could from gun to tape. It makes no sense. Yet we have created this unnatural goal, and we all strive for it. It's not surprising that we start to break down. The natural way to run, like a hunter-gatherer, would be surge and recover. You don't want to run like the animal you're hoping is going to die. You want to run a little bit smarter than that. So I think, you know, Phil's idea of every once in a while stopping and doing something else. Like, what do you think hunter-gatherers were doing? They weren't always hunting. They weren't always gathering. They were building shelters. They were looking for water. They were climbing mountains. They were moving stones. They were athletes, all-around athletes, first and foremost, and rarely special. And don't you think a lot of this is tied back into that commercialism that we were talking about before, and these images that are constantly fed to us in the media of the perfect body image, the flawless athletic performance, and it's all wrapped up in trying to sell us something. And it's something.
It's a big problem, and it's interesting to see the running windfalls that are reaped by a few people in marathoning, 10Ks and road racing in general. But if you look at the ultra scene or the trail running scene, you don't see any of that. You see a lot more people having fun.
Totally.
I was in London recently, and there's a running group. It's led by this guy who's makes music videos and records singers. And he's saying, you know what? I've been in the music industry for 25 years. I've never seen more crime and criminals than I have in running. And basically, he's talking to all people who are cashing in.
Terrible. Chris, give us a glimpse into a week in your life in terms of what kind of activities and training, workouts, exercise, movements, whatever you want to call it, that you do on a regular basis.
You know, it's funny when Phil mentioned woodcutting, because a long, long time ago, about more than 10 years ago, when I was first getting this idea that, you know, as a busted down, overweight ex-runner, I thought, you know, is there any way I could possibly train for a 50-mile race? And I began working with a coach from Jackson Hole, Eric Horton. And when I told him all the things I don't like to do, I don't want to run intervals, I don't want to do speed work, I don't want to do this, I don't want to wear a heart rate monitor. He finally looks at me, he's like, well, dude, what do you like to do? And I said, well, you know, it's funny. I like to cut firewood. And I thought he was just going to ignore that. But he said, okay, let's work with that. And again, it's kind of cool because I've been talking to Hal today about how do you train a burro? How do you train an animal to run? And Hal is basically saying, you got to make it seem like it's his idea.
Mm.
And I love the fact that Eric locked in on that. Rather than saying, well, dude, wood cutting doesn't really apply to running an ultra in a copper can. He's like, okay, that's what you want. Let's work with that. And his idea was there's some sort of repetitive motions that are rhythmic that result in some kind of concrete product that I like. That's how he started me out. And we've retained that to this day. And I still stay in touch with Eric. And he gives me tips every once in a while. But the course of my day, it's attention deficiency in practice. I get up, I do one thing, I bounce to something else. I'll cut some wood. I'll fix a fence. I'll do a little bit of indoor office work. I'll go for a run. I'll go out and play with the kids. I can never climb a rope, so I hung a rope outside my office, a 30-foot manila rope, and now I climb that every day. I just find wherever I can that catches my eye and just go play with it.
It's funny. I just told my fiance this morning that we need to get a rope in a warehouse that we're renting so I can start climbing it, because that's one like a bucket list sort of thing myself too. Getting back kind of to the diet nutrition side of things, you mentioned how you were inspired by Phil's 2-week test, and even pointing out, of course, it's not a diet. This is just a test to kind of see where things are at and start making some changes. Did you yourself take that test?
Oh, yeah.
And what did you find out about yourself?
A couple different things. The funny thing about it is that my wife actually did it first. Yeah, I kind of sort of dilly-dally, put things off. My wife leaps right in. So when she read up a 2-week test, she started it like the next day. But actually, she flamed out after 3 days, because you really need to think about what you're going to be eating and where it's going to be. And that was the first thing about the 2-week test that was important. So when my wife plunged into it, she got hungry and she looked around the house. Well, there's nothing that she can eat which would actually be within the parameters. So she ended up grabbing a bag of Doritos.
Mm.
So she had to start over again. So the first thing about the 2-week test, which is so important, is it makes you mindful of what is actually going in your mouth. So before you begin it, you got to ask yourself, okay, do I have breakfast foods around? Do I have bacon and sausage and avocados and eggs? I like to have coffee. Do I actually have whole cream around as opposed to half and half? I'm going to get snacky. Do I have some cashews around? Do I have some beef jerky that hasn't been cured in sugar? So number one, you stockpile the things you can eat.
Go shopping.
Go shopping and then make conscious choices. Number two is what I found super fast was the things I thought were going to bother me didn't. I thought I have cravings for ice cream and, you know, where's the pizza? Didn't happen at all. You get hungry, you don't get craving. And when you get hungry, you satisfy it and you're done. And the last thing was, you don't even need 2 weeks. After like 5 or 6 days, you see and feel the differences amazingly. Stomach bloat disappears. Mid-afternoon fatigue disappears. You don't have these energy swings, these mood swings. You hit this kind of glide pattern that is just so comfortable. And you can chalk up to nothing except the fact that you've changed what's going down your throat. You
know, totally.
Phil and I have worked together for so long, and I've become so in tune with the whole fat burning thing that I have something that I call the 3-day jump start. And literally, it's just going to, for me, going the 2-week test for 3 days. And
I can see tremendous differences in just the 3 days.
You know what? I do the same thing myself too. If I go out, like I kind of let myself celebrate a little bit after my marathon, but as soon as I get home and get my grocery shopping done, I'm with you, Hal. Like I can jumpstart that right back. Mm-hmm. Totally.
I don't recommend that for somebody who wants to give this a try and is just starting out. But I think once you're in tune with that, it's give yourself 3 days of the 2 week test and you get back on track really fast.
Yeah. Chris, was the 2 week test for you an eye opening thing? Like, was that a catalyst and that led you into doing more of the fat adaptation approach with your overall nutrition?
You know, Phil's point before, you're not going to talk somebody into doing something they don't want to do.
Yeah.
I love the genius of the 2 week test because, you know, I've had arguments with people and I've learned to not have any more. When you start talking about barefoot running, that you get 50,000, yeah, but. And you say, dude, just run around the block. Just take off your shoes. Why are we talking about it? Just do it. That to me is the genius of the 2 week test. You can read 50,000 books about what you should eat and shouldn't eat, or you can just cut the crap out of your diet for 2 weeks and see how you feel. And
what a concept.
I know. It's what I love about it. I think it's brilliant. It's an argument winner. Don't argue. Don't cite any nutritional studies. Take all the man-made stuff out of your diet. End of 2 weeks, 14 days, see how you feel. In my personal case, within a couple days, I was won over. I was convinced. End of 2 weeks. Physically, I had changed. Emotionally, I was different. And it's been years now. I don't even recall exactly. It must have been like more than 4 years since I've done this. And everybody I've also guided this way. Phil, here's another example. I was down in Virginia at a running shoe store. I'm basically in the lair of the enemy and giving a talk. And the owner of the store was a big kind of heavy set football kind of guy. He'd never actually heard of Born to Run. He wasn't a runner himself. He basically was selling like bicycles and canoes and things. Anyway, I got an email from him a couple weeks ago. He said he read the book, tried a 2 week test, and within 2 weeks he lost 11 pounds. His eating is transformed. But this is a guy who was not looking to be convinced, and yet he gave it a try as an experiment and completely transformed him.
It's amazing. I'm still amazed after all these years. I don't know when, it was probably in 1982 that the 2 week test was developed, because I decided that convincing people to not eat junk food was too difficult. And what I needed to do was give them a simpler option where they could actually feel what it's like. And it was a big hit. But among the things that I've done, with patients through my career, it has produced the most miracles by far than all the other things combined.
Yeah, you know, it's such a good point. Instead of telling people, you know, like, here's your diet parameters, but, you know, for the lifetime, and some people look at it, because speaking to what you guys are even talking about, even with the donkey, you have to make the donkey think that it's his idea to, you know, want to do this. And it's the same thing with this diet stuff. And it's the thing I probably see, I struggle with the most with clients and people I work with, is that they still think I'm probably one level. I'm their mom shaking my finger at them, telling them what they need to do, even though they've sought out my advice for this. It's, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's sad in a way, you know, every animal on earth knows how to eat except for humans. And we have to get back to our humanity and relearn how to eat using our instincts, using our intuitions. And, again, a lot of the problem is simply that we've all been brainwashed. You know, I grew up in the radio and TV era, with commercials every 10 minutes. And, you know, today it's the technology that hits people over the head saying, you know, buy our junk food because you'll be a better person. And it's tough to get away from that, but that's what it's all about.
Yeah. And, you know, Chris, like we were talking about too, you know, just how things shifted once there was a lot of money to be made in sports nutrition, marketing, you know, marketing of all kinds of products. That really seems to be a huge reason why things changed with diet in a lot of athletes before, like going back to the olden days, you know, even back as far as World War II, like you were talking about in some of the stories you were sharing, when that was just natural. I mean, that's just fat adaptation. It just was what it was. Like, there was no like saying, oh, I'm high carb or low carb. It just, it is what it is at that point, you know?
And the thing about it too, again, the thing I love about the 2 week test is it's not made me a purist. You know, you put Eggs Benedict in front of me, I'm not getting rid of the English muffin. I'm eating the crap out of Eggs Benedict. But the difference now is I know the consequences. Okay, if I eat this roll, I'm going to feel sluggish afterwards. But, you know, if it's worth it to me, I'll eat it. If it's not, then I won't. But the thing I like about it so much about this kind of stuff that Phil's doing is that it's just clearing out all the radio static. So now I know what the cause and effects are. In the past, you didn't. You're in a running shoe store. You look at that bewildering wall of footwear. You've got no idea if your performance somehow matches to something on this wall or not. You don't know if your ailment is being worsened or alleviated by the thing. And it's the same with food. We feel all these things in our bodies every day, but we don't really know what the cause and effects are. And again, that's what I love about the 2 week test is it just brings things back to first principles where you realize the thing I'm swallowing is going to have an effect on my body. And I know what that effect is.
Absolutely. So guys, before we wind down today, Chris, I want to ask, what else can we expect to find in your new book, Natural Born Heroes? I mean, it sounds like there's some fascinating stories in here that are not just, you know, related to fitness, but you're learning some history along the way. So what else can we find in here?
I think the most important thing is we've developed this notion of the other, that other people are bigger or stronger and tougher than we are, that men are different than women. And again, when you look back at the ancient Greeks, who were an extraordinarily practical and pragmatic people, they realized, you know, you can't have a species where people are separated, where one guy is big and strong and everybody else has to wait for this hero to come along. It makes much more sense if everybody can perform on a high level. And they realized it's not that difficult to do. So what I found was a couple basic things. One is this idea of the hero. It just means to be capable. It's not about being brave, because when you know what you're doing, bravery isn't an issue. The second thing is that there are three elements to it: compassion, strength, and skill. And these are three things which we can practice on a daily basis that will make us sort of better than we were before. So I think the overall message of Natural Born Hero is that the kind of things that Hal and Phil make their daily life, the rest of us need to relearn this stuff, and we'll be much happier and much healthier if we do.
Do you have other examples, other characters in your book, so to speak, of guys or people doing certain things? Like, I know you mentioned the parkour, but other types of characters who are quote-unquote natural-born heroes?
Yeah, well, there's a woman named Narina Bensel. She was a principal in her 50s in a rural school not too far from me in Pennsylvania. And Narina was working at her desk one day, and she noticed a man at the front door sort of fumbling with the door. And when she got up to see what he wanted, someone else came along, and he was able to slip inside. So she went down the corridor to find out what was going on. And as she approached him, he pulls out a machete and attacks her. Again, this is a woman about 5'3", had never been in a fight in her life, in her 50s, is now confronting an ex-Army veteran with a machete in his hand who is out to kill her. And the things that she did next, I don't think they were accidents. She wasn't trained for them directly, but it made all the difference between life and death in that school. She didn't curl up into a ball and plead for mercy. She didn't scream and cry. She maintained eye contact with him. She raised her hands in an X in front of her face and began backing away, leading this man away from the children. He still went after her. He tried to kill her. At one point, she slumped to the floor, covered in blood. When he turned his back to her to go after the kids, she leaps up and then grabs him around the arms from the back and locks her arms together. What she basically did was use her fascia, all that rubbery tendon in her body, to turn herself into like a human lasso. At that point, he drops the machete, but she doesn't let go of that hug. She continues to hug him, and something about that hug flipped a switch in his brain, and he just stayed up to fight. And later on, at his trial, she looked him in the face and she said, you know, I hugged you to comfort you. And he looked at her and he goes, I know. When we talk about strength, skill, and compassion, and the fact that this was a person that you would not identify conventionally as a hero, yet in the moment of crisis, I defy you to find people who are going to react better than she did. And I think the reason why was because the things that she knew how to do, from dealing with children, from keeping eye contact, keeping your cool, meeting aggression with comfort and warmth. All these things she'd been training her entire life. And to me, that is what the natural art of the hero is all about.
That's incredible. Oh my gosh. All right. Well, I think we all need to pick up a copy of the book. It is out at this point, right?
Sure is. It is, and it's amazing. And I was a fan of Born to Run, but I think Christopher really has something with natural born heroes.
Cool, cool. We'll provide links to the book and Chris and Hal and Phil and all that at enduranceplanet.com under the show notes for this episode. But in the meantime, Chris and Hal, where can we easily find out more about you guys? Where can we find out more about Burro Racing too?
Well, with Burro Racing, look up www.packburroracing.com. We have a calendar of events and results there. You can find me at www.hardscrabbletimes.com. And then Chris?
Yeah, chrismcdougal.com.
Cool. Easy. Easy, simple. Well, I want to thank you guys so much for taking the time out of that gorgeous Colorado day to hang out with us over here. It's been truly a pleasure getting to talk with both of you, meet you, Chris, and meet you too, Hal. I'm so excited to read the book. It's speaking to me, guys. So, and thank you. And then also to have Phil on the phone at the same time. I mean, I like this. This is some good synergy right here.
Yeah, thanks, Tony.
Thanks for reading it. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem.